This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Brave Rangers in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Stay with us as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works across differences to get things done and to bring us closer together.
Well, Glenn, we had a great conversation with Lisa McNair in our previous episode. In the second episode, she really unpacks more about those skills that she was referring to in the first episode and talks about the importance of emotion regulation and the importance of being motivated to truly understand another person, as well as working on our own self-awareness. And I found that to be very interesting and hope that our guest will, as well as they listen to the second part of our interview with Lisa. All right, well, one of the things you mentioned related to education and teaching communication skills across differences in all levels of education, and I'd love to hear more about your thoughts on that in terms of what kind of communication skills and how those may be taught. I know Braver Angels right now has a group that's looking at K-12 education and how we can bring in some work in terms of our workshops, both with teachers but also with students. And one of my good friends from California that I've met through Braver Angels is actually kind of spearheading the work on that. So I'm curious as to what are you thinking in terms of bringing those communication skills in across, you know, communication skills for talking across differences at all levels of education. What might that look like?
Well, I haven't really thought about it in great detail, but I'm so excited to hear that Braver Angels is doing that. And I mean, somewhere in my conscience, I might have heard something about that, but I knew they were working with churches more and some other areas. It seems like there's so much going on, but that delights me to hear. You know, I only taught school for about 3 years, and it was sixth grade. But I value that experience so much. And what is so true is that every day of teaching kids, there are teachable moments about being a human being, about how to experience the world. It can be information level, but can certainly opportunities to process emotions and skills on how to get along with each other. You can't run a classroom unless people have some boundaries about respect and listening to each other and following certain kind of rules to get around. So I think the classroom is this ideal kind of setting. And learning how to integrate that, you know, I don't think it has to be just a class on communication skills, but it would probably require having teachers trained a little bit better about that so that they can start to spot opportunities. Learning, you know, it could be around any issue. You could take a history lesson and talk about, do a debate and use a debate format for kids to talk about different issues and how they debate those different issues passionately but respectfully. I think that you could have discussions about science, the future of science, and ethics in science, and how responsible we are about science, and present different points of view. When kids get in disagreements about how things should happen, you know, being the model for teachers to model respect for differences, but also taking a moment for kids to stop arguing and to start listening. So interrupting that process between them, you know, and hopefully the teacher has the maturity and some skills training too, because I do think it's a skill you learn. These are skills that can be taught, and just because you're a teacher or an adult doesn't mean you've really been exposed to that or had those opportunities to kind of break that down and learn how to step back and recognize those situations. So I think just, you know, there's so many contexts I can imagine this being taught, but again, history lessons come to mind really quickly, talking about the history of our country and what a democracy means and how messy it is, to be a human being and be expected to respect and treasure other people's point of view. It's so different from your own. And just the beauty of that, even though it's challenging at times. So I think it's you might build it into a curriculum, and it could be in almost any subject matter, but I feel pretty certain it's going to have to start with teachers being trained, and then maybe doing some kind of formal training with kids, but it's only going to work if you're integrating it into just all these different aspects of learning, because conflict comes up almost on a daily basis. See, there's plenty of learning opportunities. Yeah.
Braver Angels, one of the groups that they've been connecting with really closely is a group called Bridge USA, which is a nonpartisan group, and they've gone into colleges and into the high school environment in which they teach people how to do these kinds of respectful dialogues, but and discourse, and so they have resources for teachers as well as for the students themselves who are working on these kinds of issues. And I think there are a lot of bridge building organizations that are trying to increase our willingness to actually interrupt. I love that what you said, interrupting the process of dehumanization towards other people. So I think about that. And you know, one of the things that I think about though that people will say is that you know, not all folks agree with compromise. They'll just say, well, why is this? This seems like you're just reducing your values in order to be able to be nice to other people. And I do wonder about sometimes when we talk about civility. Civility can be, you know, defined as politeness. And politeness can also be used to silence voices that need to be calling for change. And so one of the things that I think about is how do we deal with that kind of argument of, if I'm going to just be listening and trying to, you know, model the respect as a teacher or interrupt that process and try to listen to the other person's stories, what if I really think the other person is, you know, what they're talking about is really not good. And how do I deal with those kinds of folks?
That's a great question. That's kind of at the heart of why it's so difficult, because that disagreement, and it can be passionate disagreement, is very real. And to pretend that it's not important, it, I think, is a disservice to ourselves, and it's dishonest. And you know, I think about Southern politeness. Some of the cruelest people I know had the best manners. I mean, they will kill you with their smiles and honeys and sweetness and you know, just don't turn your back. So politeness can be a cover for cruelty, I think, sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then the other issue or term you brought up was this compromise. There's compromise, and then there's compromise. There's compromise when people who disagree come to a solution that isn't perfectly what they want, but it's something that's livable to good, fits their values enough. I think too often compromise is more brutal. It's a tearing apart, like two dogs with a bone, you know, and neither one really gets what they want. And so they walk away from the compromise, still both sides feeling very dissatisfied and angry. And I don't think that those are good compromise. I don't think that's really even a compromise. It's a trade-off. So I think, again, that's a simplistic way to deal with compromise. Too often, I think these compromises and these solutions are rushed into too quickly, without having enough voices at the table, without really sincerely exploring solutions that are workable versus self-serving. And I think that comes back to issues of leadership again. And that's when I was thinking about doing this interview today, I was reminded of a training I did right after graduate school, and it was constructed by a man named Edwin Friedman. He's deceased now. He was a clinical psychologist, but also a rabbi. And he did these workshops on leadership. And one of the things that I found so powerful in his writing and so true is that leadership is hard. Leadership needs the most mature people. And being in power is not the same as being a leader. And so that there's certain qualities in leadership. And I think that there is some, we've been lacking some really great leadership for a while. And leadership is not about getting your own way. It's about listening to the people that have given you the privilege of leading them. And so but back to your comment about compromise and listening to, and disagreeing, you know, the disagreements, I think our differences and our disagreements actually have the potential to be one of our greatest strengths, because disagreement is also differing perspectives. And so if we can stick with it long enough to understand where we're actually disagreeing, what we're actually after, then I think compromises and I think really viable solutions can be found. But it takes patience and it takes leadership. And we don't really operate that way all the time.
It reminds me of something that I teach in my classes where they talk about, there's this like triangle, and people can't see what I'm doing on the screen here as we're talking, but they talk about that we oftentimes start with, you know, we're divergent in our opinions, we have differences of ideas, and we can move too quickly to convergence of ideas because we don't like the chaos zone in the middle, because the chaos zone is where I'm feeling discomfort, I'm feeling fearful, I am getting triggered potentially, I'm not sometimes willing to listen all the way through to what a person's saying because it seems like that I am really just totally, you know, being attacked, but yet I haven't really heard their story, what's led them there, and not willing to look at a variety of different possibilities. And if we can stay long enough in that chaos zone, then we can find common ground and values that it is that we can potentially build on.
You know, that makes me think that staying in that chaotic zone long enough to reach some understandings is really a skill that we need to be teaching. And it reminds me of some of the emotion regulation things that we talk about in our field in psychology those are not skills we normally talk about unless we're in therapy or something like that. Maybe that should be one of those basic things that's covered in education, like you were talking about, Lisa, because if we get into conflict, we're going to have those uncomfortable moments. And we have to be able to learn to tolerate that discomfort long enough and to have a system that we can follow and persist in to be able to reach some understanding with the other person and find some common ground. That's kind of my thinking and reaction to what you're saying, April. But kind of maybe related to this, it ends up being the need to find some common ground among opposing sides in our country politically. So I'm going to ask you this, Lisa, if you could identify maybe one or two issues currently that tend to divide reds and blues and yet might offer the possibility that both sides could find some common ground and maybe even get to that point past chaos to compromise, even though they still maintain some differences. Can you think of any issues like that where there's promise for that sort of thing?
I'm just going to say this. I think we're more alike. Human beings are certainly more alike. And this is not my new idea, obviously. We're more alike than different. You know, I've never spoken to someone, even the staunchest conservative friend that I have, who said, I want our children to go to schools where there's lots of guns and we never know that they're going to be safe. No one has ever said that. No one. And so, you know, that we fight about and the conversations get derailed into, we're going to take guns away from you. We're going to take all of your liberties away from you. That's the only way we can have safety in our schools or how to make sure our communities and our schools are safe. So I think that it's one of those issues we fight a lot about and seem to make no progress. And I think My suspicion is we make no progress because there are invested parties that don't want anything to change, that this is all working for them. So either making a lot of money or however that works. But the truth is, I think Reds and Blues really value child safety, community safety, that they have concerns about that. I think that's one issue. Another would be healthcare. I think there's a lot of agreement that we would like to have really top-notch, good, reliable healthcare that's affordable to everyone. And now how we get there, I think that there's some differences of how to do that. But I think most people, I have a hard time imagining someone saying, no, I don't want anyone to have healthcare. Now they might say, I don't want to finance it, or it's too much of a burden for employers, or there's a lot of problems with providing it. But the starting point is, would we like to have healthcare that's good, excellent, and accessible? And would we all benefit from it? I think that there's a lot of consensus around those issues. So I think the noise comes from people more interested in the power and advantages they get from things not changing. And I don't think it's coming from the actual body of citizens who want our country to handle these problems better than we are. So I think there's a lot of environment. You mentioned environment. I don't think anyone wants to see the earth destroyed I think that our ability to look at the problems gets all clouded because these other issues get thrown in there, kind of a smokescreen or red herring or whatever, however you want to describe it. It gets muddied around what the true issues are, and it's staying clear about the issues and how we're going to solve them. And again, I think that goes back to leadership.
You may be familiar with one of the things that Braver Angels does in some of our Red Blue workshops. We do some things, exercises. One is called the stereotypes exercise, and we ask a group of Reds and a group of Blues who meet separately for a moment, and they ask them, tell us what you think are some stereotypes about your group, your party, or your color, and what do you think the truth is on that? And so I'm going to, and sometimes we've been doing this some with folks, and I'd like you to answer that too. Since you didn't say it in so many words, but clearly you lean blue in some fashion. So could you maybe identify a stereotype or two where you feel Reds may have about Blues, and then say what you think the reality is about that stereotype?
I think one stereotype is that blue people, Blues, Democrats, liberals, waste money. They're not accountable. They'll spend money and throw money at causes and not get much done. And they're irresponsible financially, that they're not good stewards of our financial resources. And I think it's a stereotype, but I think the kernel of truth is that maybe well-intentioned, some of the programs that we come up with ideas that we're going to fix something become these bureaucratic messes and sometimes don't even solve the problem that they initially set out to do. So I think that there is waste, and I'm not going to defend it. Even if there's good intentions, it is what it is. I mean, I think that there are times that actually not creating the solution and spending money and throwing money at a problem versus really coming up with a well thought out, well funded enough, but not just continually throwing good money after, good money after bad or whatever. To say, well, we just need more money and that'll fix it. A little more money and we'll fix it. And then a little more, and it just gets to be this convoluted solution. So I think that there's some truth to that. I think that there is some impractical or not well thought out solutions, even if it's around issues that I want to support and care deeply about, I don't think it's always handled right, and I don't think it's always managed well.
So in terms of kind of financial responsibility, that's an area where you think there may be some weaknesses or some basis for some of the stereotypes Reds have. To what extent, if any, do you think that may be exaggerated? What might be the more accurate portrayal of how much Blues tend to be financially responsible?
All parties are capable of wasting money. It depends on what you call waste, you know, whether it's something you value more than another issue or not. But, you know, we've had some Blue presidents who have managed our, you know, to have decreased the deficit, that have managed money pretty, you know, not perfectly. And certainly, you know, I'm not trying to paint a distorted picture, but have made efforts to manage money more effectively. I think, you know, I identify as a Blue, and I want accountability. I want to see my tax dollars spent for programs that are run effectively and efficiently. I want my campaign contributions to be used for candidates that are worthy of it. And I don't want to just keep writing a check for more bad government, you know, for more, you know, just to feed that engine. So, you know, I'm a Blue, and that I feel I want financial responsibility. And I think a lot of my friends do too, who have similar values, political values and social values. So I don't think that they have to go hand in hand at all. And I don't think that they do all the time.
So, you know, the question that Glenn, that you're asking, and one of the reasons I think that they ask that question in Braver Angels, in the Red Blue workshop in particular, is because it's helpful for us to understand that, first of all, that our own side is stereotyped by the other side. And I'm on the other side of the political aisle from you, Lisa, and I could answer the question a different way, but come up with similar kinds of things. And it's important for us to recognize that we do participate in this stereotyping as well, where we're grouping people together all in one kind of group. And we really aren't recognizing the nuances, the individual kinds of things that people bring into their thoughts. And just think about you as an example, as we've been talking about. I mean, you've been an educator, you've been a psychologist, you've been a volunteer, you've been a mom, you're a grandma. And like, there's so many different identities that are part of who you are. And if I just group you into the one of, oh, she's progressive, then I lose so much of what you are as a human being. And I think sometimes that we can certainly do that. You know, there's a tendency, I think it's this all or nothing thinking that also happens, for us to minimize any positives on the other side. And even as our listeners who might be less progressive might be listening to you talk about those stereotypes, and they might say, yeah, but. That's kind of what we do sometimes, is yeah, but, because we can think of alternative examples. I think it's helpful, and I'd love to have your thinking about this, of how do we, you know, maybe from a psychologist perspective, how do we get out of this all or none approach that we tend to see only positives on our own side, and we excessively criticize the other side, you know. The attributions that we have of ourselves are good, but the attributions we have of others are not so good. How do we get out of that psychological tendency?
It takes effort, and I think we have to be motivated to want to understand. And you know, we talked earlier about this idea of being curious about the other person. So I think we have to really work on recognizing assumptions that we make, and they slip out all the time. It's one of the things I've appreciated about the Braver Angels training, and how careful they our scripts are about language, because we betray our values all the time. I mean, we share our values, we share our biases all the time, and it's just who we are. And I think owning and being honest about who we are and how we think about things, but working on this idea of empathy, these exercises, I think are really helpful. where you are asked to look at yourself and asked to describe both your strengths and weaknesses. I mean, there's so many approaches to this. Again, in education, you could do this, start this with kids too, you know, being able to be critical thinkers and know that all or nothing really doesn't exist usually. I mean, death and life, I guess, might be the ultimate example of it, but I'm not even too sure about that. It's about working on your self-awareness and saying, am I a person who is biased? Absolutely. Absolutely. Am I a person that can jump to stereotypes? Yes, because stereotypes make life easier. We make judgment calls every single day, and sometimes they're wrong, but we're wired that way for survival. You know, we look at a situation and go, should I go down that dark alley by myself at 2 a.m. when there's a suspicious looking person there? Well, what makes someone suspicious looking? And then all of our biases come out because someone could look very innocent and sweet and be a deadly person. So, but we make those judgment calls for a reason around survival. The problem is we're not always in survival mode, but we act like we are. And so that anxiety about, I think, working to calm ourselves down, you know, learning that self-regulation, you know, we were talking about teaching that to our kids at a really early age, like stop, think about, assess the situation, what is true and what is not true. And it's a training process, and we're working on it all the time. So yeah, we make judgment calls because it makes decision making easier, but not all decisions need to be made easily. And sometimes we act as if they should, and we wish that they could be. Does that make sense?
That's profound. Not all decisions need to be made easily. So I think about that, and yes, that does make sense.
I want to say that pie in the sky kind of attitude, or Pollyanna attitude, that all we need to do is hold hands, look each other in the eye and share our feelings. You know, that doesn't happen easily, and it's not going to. I mean, we're passionate people or not passionate enough, or not, you know, don't have much interest or disinterest in some issues, but it's work. It's work to really engage in the world with other people, and we're not going to be able to do that with everybody. So what I want to say is that there are times when we do have to walk away from a situation, that we can't always have these deep, meaningful conversations that's going to transform our relationships with each other. There are some situations that are dangerous or maybe too hot to handle in that moment. And that we have to, it's like, well, that this conversation's not working. And just acknowledge that. I think one of the ways to disengage is to say, you know, I don't think we're going to make any progress right now talking about this topic. Both of us are getting really upset, and being upset and trying to have a logical conversation, that they're usually not compatible. So, and I do think that there are some people that want disruption and want to cause chaos. And I think we have to be able to recognize when that is going on. And so that's another part of the skills learning, is recognizing situations where can we, with baby steps, identify that this is a safe place to be curious and to share how we're thinking about things. And when it starts to feel, you know, not safe or disrespectful, to say, this is not the circumstances, or these are not the parameters that are going to work for us to have this conversation. So we need to just stop. And the other person may be yelling or screaming, but we walk away and say, I'm willing to talk when this changes. And we see that, and, you know, I see that as a clinician when I've worked with very hot-headed family members, and some who've not spoken to each other or have had even violence in their relationship. So I'm not naive about this. I know that there are dangerous situations, but people can learn to de-escalate, and people can learn to be civil, and can learn when it's time to walk away. Now, are all people motivated to learn all those things? No, but I think a majority of people are interested.
So if I understand you correctly, there are difficult conversations you can have with people who aren't necessarily in a good place at the moment, but there may be hope for some of those, but there are some times when it reaches a level you clearly have to recognize that and exit the conversation. The other thing I think I heard you say, it was alluding to the notion of there are some bad actors out there where if you can figure out that they're not about resolving anything, they're only about using whatever comes up for their own or their own group's gains for power purposes. And that may also be something where these conversations aren't going to get you anywhere. Did I kind of hear that right?
Yeah, I think you probably said it with greater clarity than I did. But, you know, the humans, we're capable of incredible goodness and we're capable of evil as well. And I would say that for every human being, we're capable. Mm-hmm. What we choose to do is a different matter. And what we want to do and how we want to be in the world, I think, is critical. But I certainly don't think it's the majority at all. I think it's a pretty small percentage, but it can still be powerful and dangerous. And so I think we have to be aware of when that there has to be this kind of social agreement of our goal is to be respectful, you know, at some point. And if it breaks down, it might mean we can come back later and try again. But if it breaks down because of something much more dangerous, other motivations that are more dangerous, then maybe that's not the approach to resolving with that particular person or group of people. So
my question for you would be, what do you recommend for others on what they can do themselves or in their communities to make a difference? Things that they can do to help bridge the political divide, either personally or in the community?
Gosh, that's a big question. I mean, I think that there's work at a kind of a cellular level, you know? I mean, sometimes it's getting involved politically, but it could also just be working in your community and building relationships with people in your community. I think that that helps. I don't think it even has to be a political objective. It can be a human objective of just connecting with each other. And I think when we have that community, when we see each other as people, then when other political issues come up, it you've got some foundation there to maybe approach some of these discussions around how we're going to resolve it and work together. So I think the first goal should be learning to be a better human being and connecting with your community and your neighbors and at any level that you can.
Yeah, so my last question is really, how do you see the work with Braver Angels in Arkansas helping with doing that?
I think we're still building the foundation for letting people know what we do and that it's not dangerous to come to the workshops. And whenever I talk about Braver Angels and the work that Braver Angels is doing and what we're doing, they'll go, that's incredible. We need that. But they're not showing up for the call. They're not showing up for the workshop. Yeah, you know, we need it, meaning I think everybody else needs it. And so I think it's going to require patience, but I think the work is solid. I think it's meaningful. And I think my prediction is it will grow exponentially the more people get exposed and have experiences with Braver Angels. And I think we're not quite there at that tipping point, but I see it as being a very, potentially very viable, very, very important training opportunity for our community. I really do. And I think it just needs enough people who have had the experience with it to understand what it's about and how powerful it can be.
I appreciate the work that, Lisa, that you're doing at the local level in Arkansas in terms of Braver Angels and for helping us create a vision for how we can do that in our wonderful state. So thank you for coming and being our guest today. We've certainly enjoyed hearing your thoughts and the perspective that you've shared. I know I've learned a lot about you and the thoughts, and I've been taking a whole bunch of notes because I've been thinking about some things that I want to be practicing in my own life. So thank you for coming on our program.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and it's been a pleasure talking with both of you.
We hope you enjoyed the second part of today's discussion with Lisa McNair. Be sure to check out the first part of the two-part conversation we had with Lisa, as well as other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand. You can find that on the podcast page of the Braver Angels Arkansas website at arkansas.braverangels.org or on many popular podcast sites.
And when you visit our website, you can let us know what you think about our program by responding to a brief survey using the link on our podcast webpage. For program or speaker ideas or other feedback, email us at otherhandar@gmail.com. Again, that's otherhandar@gmail.com. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor. From your host, April Chatham Carpenter,
and Glenn White,
let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.